Class 2CM-1, second generation English ministry. This is a case study. So our speaker, Reverend Richard Cook, is an associate professor of church history and mission at a local evangelical seminary. He has been a missionary in Taiwan for 10 years. His wife, Ruth, is from Taiwan also. They have three grandchildren. And Reverend Cook got his master's degree of divinity and theology from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and a PhD in modern Chinese history from the University of Iowa. So now please let us welcome Reverend Cook, okay? Here, please. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much.
Okay, good afternoon. We are going to be talking about English ministry and second generation ministry. And the first thing you might want to notice is that I am neither first generation Chinese, nor am I second generation Chinese. And so I wonder what I'm doing here. I have to say it's bit of a stretch, but it's something that since I've been involved in ministries, Chinese church ministries, first generation Chinese church ministries, it's a ministry that I've observed for about 30 years, starting when I was in Chicago and getting to know Chinese churches. And what I found is that I probably very naturally relate to the first generation Chinese. My background is that after I finished my undergraduate studies at University of Illinois in Chicago, I moved to Taiwan where I began to learn Mandarin. I got married in Taiwan to a Taiwanese wife, and I began to just identify completely with the Chinese, Taiwanese church world. We moved to the United States. We went to first generation churches, and we were involved in leadership. We went back to Taiwan. And I really identify with the first generation. And my kids, who've grown up both in Taiwan and the U.S., seem to identify more closely with second generation. However, as a first generation Chinese, I always had a peculiar talent that other first-generation Chinese didn't have, and that is that I speak English like a second-generation Chinese person. And so I found that the second-generation Chinese people tended to gravitate toward me. And so if there is a problem with the first generation, if there's a problem they're having with the elders or the pastors, I found that the second generation would often think they could talk to me and get particular help, maybe, and some sympathy from me. And so I, for 30 years, feel like I have been blessed or cursed with hearing both sides of this debate. And the reason I want to talk about this, and this is just where I want to start with, is because when I talk to the first generation, so I'm a first generation person, I teach at Logos Seminary, my ministry is to first generation, that has been my heart, that has been my life, my calling to missions was to be a missionary in Taiwan and in China. So that's been my life. So the question is, why did I ever get involved in a second generation English ministry? And so that's what I'm trying to say. When I'm hearing the arguments from both sides of the equation, first and second generation, what I hear from the first generation people, the people I relate with, is our hearts are broken. Our hearts are broken. Because we want nothing more in the world than for our children to grasp hold of the faith that we have. Because for the first generation people, so many of us are first generation Christians. And we know what it was like before we came to Christ. And we know how Christ thoroughly transformed us. And that's an experience our children didn't really have because they grew up in the church. And so we know what the non-Christian life is like, and we know how Christ transformed us, and we want nothing more than for our children to embrace that faith. So I hear that, and I resonate with that. That's the heart I have for my children. And then on the other hand, I'm hearing from the second generation, and they just can't see that. They just can't feel or experience, it seems, that heart that the parents have. And they feel frustrated, and they feel overlooked, and they feel that there is no future for them within the Chinese American church, or maybe within the church at all. And they are hurting. And so I feel like I hear both sides of the equation, and it just breaks my heart. And as the opportunity came for me to be involved in this ministry, I thought, well, that's not my business. That's, you know, it's a second generation. If I'm Chinese at all, I'm first generation. But then I thought, if I can play a role, actually, the first generation, I believe, should be extremely thankful. If we can find a way to effectively bring second generation Chinese people into our churches or into the churches, into, at the very least, into a relationship with Jesus Christ. And so I feel like my serving in a second generation church, in a sense, is a ministry to the first generation in trying to help us find an effective avenue of ministry, a way to help our children to grow into the church. So we are doing a second generation English ministry. If you read the description of this section, in February 2016, 2.5 years ago, a new church was born, Generations Church of Los Angeles. I'll talk a little bit about this. Started by a core group from this church. We used to meet in the English ministry, Harvest LA, just across the courtyard here, until February 2016. So that's the story that I want to talk about. It's a 5-year story. We were born February 7th, 2016, so I'll start with year -2 and year -1, and then our birth, and then we're now in our third year. So that's basically the outline we'll go through, and I'll tell some of the issues, I'll share some of the issues that I've observed as we go along. Why am I involved? First and second generation, that's what I just shared. I just have a heart to see the second generation reached as a first generation Christian or a first generation person. I share that passion. And here I just want to insist, there are people, honest people of good faith on both sides. That's what I see. I hear the children criticizing their parents or the elders and the pastors, and I say, if you only could see how much they care and how much they don't want to frustrate you, how much they don't want to hurt you, but they seem to do it anyway. And in the same way, I think sometimes the elders, the pastors, the parents don't always realize that the kids really want to be part, but they don't feel that it's open completely to them. Some problems that I've observed, so let me just throw out, there's so many things I could have done and spent the entire hour on, and so I just need to move quickly. But some problems that I've observed that critical and central to the problem of what's going on. There's a subtle culturalism or sinocentrism is a word that I've learned among Chinese peoples. And I add here, it's not malicious, it's not intended, but it's just something that you can't get over. And so here's the illustration that I have that I can test you, maybe, if for you first generation people. Because I think the second generation people are going to see my side. And the first generation people are going to see my father-in-law's side. So I was dating my girlfriend, my current wife. I was dating her. We were living in Taiwan. And I lived in Taiwan for several weeks. And I love Chinese food. I love the Taiwanese food. But after several weeks and a month, I needed American food, and I found McDonald's, and it just saved me. It was so important for me. We didn't have a word. That was 1984, 1985. We didn't have the word that I'm aware of called comfort food. but now we use that word. But it was a comfort food. That was the perfect description of it. And I would eat that. And then I got to know my girlfriend, and we got to be very close, and we were thinking of getting married. And so, of course, I got to know her family. And her father was from mainland China, Wei Sungren, and he spoke with a thick accent from Jiangsu, and I never understood a word he said, no matter how much Mandarin I learned. And he was high blood pressure, and he'd yell at me, and it was very standard, traditional father worried about his daughter dating an American. So he was strict and mean. But when he found out that I ever spent money on American food, he would be furious, and he would yell at me and say, "Don't waste your money. It's my money. We're not even married. What are you talking about? What difference does it make how I spend my money?" Because, of course, McDonald's or any American food, Western food, very expensive in the 1980s in Taiwan, but it was worth it. It was the only thing keeping me sane, I think. And he never could see that. He said, "Spend your money on clothes." He wasn't Chris. He said, "Spend your money on clothes. People can see clothes, right? Then they'll think more of you or whatever." And I don't care about what I look like. I just need to survive in Taiwan. He never got that. So I married. And my wife and I moved to Chicago when I was in seminary. And Mr. Lee and Mrs. Lee came to visit. And we were living in a suburb of Chicago, about an hour and 15 minutes from Chinatown, in downtown Chicago, and 2.5 hours if it's rush hour. And they were coming for about 8 or 9 days, and so we planned one trip to Chinatown. You know, Chicago, Chinatown, no big deal. It's not great, but they should see it. So we planned one trip. And of course, first day, he said, "We're going to Chinatown." We said, "Okay." And we sat in traffic for 2.5 hours. We got there, and we ate in Chinatown and drove back another hour and a half, 2 hours. It was terrible, but that's what they wanted to do. The next day, what are we having for dinner? Chinatown. And in 7 days, he forced us to go to Chinatown 3 times. We could not stop him. And I thought, okay, I get it. I've lived in Taiwan and I had to have Western food, right? And now he lives in Chicago. I mean, it was only a week, so I went a lot longer than that. But anyway, right? And so I get it. He needs his own food. And so I thought, but this is my chance. He's going to understand why I spend money at McDonald's in Taiwan. So I told him. And what did he say? He did not understand. He didn't get mad. He didn't disagree. He just didn't get it. Why? Very subtle culturalism. For me to say, "I'm a Westerner, I need Western food. He's a Chinese, he needs Chinese food." I say that's the same thing. For him, what does he see? He's a human being, and he needs human food. And I'm a human being, and so all I should really need is human food. And so it didn't make any sense to him, for me to say, "You're Chinese, you need Chinese. I'm Western, I need Western." And so it wasn't malicious, it wasn't intended, but I just think that is a very subtle attitude. And I'm not saying Americans don't have it, I'm not saying Russians don't have it, or Italians, or anybody else, but I'm saying Chinese people also do have it. And that's our focus for today. So first generation, I think if you can't see that, if you can see my point, then I think you're thinking in a more Western standpoint. If you're thinking like my father-in-law, yeah, of course, it's just food. And there's non-Chinese food, or non-food, which is Western, French, or whatever, Mexican, whatever else. So I think that's at the core of some of the issues of what's going on. The second one I found very persuasive also, and this was given by a Korean scholar, and she was speaking at a academic conference, and she had done research for a book on her Korean church in Los Angeles. And one of her key conclusions and one of the key problems for English ministry within the Korean churches, she said, is that English EM is always a ministry of the first generation. And think about what that means. What else is a ministry of the church? Sunday school is a ministry of the church. So the senior pastor is in charge of Sunday school ministry. And if there are personnel decisions to be made, the senior pastor makes personnel decisions. If there are questions of direction, if there's questions of polity, if there's questions of anything, it's directed by the senior pastor, the elders, the leadership of the church. That's fine for Sunday school. But what's different about English ministry from Sunday school? When these kids are 10, 15, 18 maybe, it's okay. But at what age should these English ministry people not be under that umbrella of the senior pastor, of the first generation, of the deacons, elders, leadership board, pastoral board? At what age do you outgrow that? So in other words, these people are always a ministry. They're always just only a Sunday school. So there's Sunday school ministry, there's English ministry, there's women's ministry, there's all these ministries, and EM is just one of them. But at what age should these English ministry people have independence? When they're 20? 30? 40? 50? When they're 50, now they're older than the senior pastor, right? And they're still a ministry under that. They've been in the church for 30, 40 years in some cases. And so it's just a constant issue, a constant problem. How do you get around that issue? So these are two key issues that I have looked at. So we're looking at a five-year window. We start with 2 years before we started Generations Church. We left because of a crisis. And what I want to say about our crisis is nothing. I just want to say I have been in church after church in Chicago and Taiwan, and every church has a crisis. And the details of the crisis, I don't think in this case study, make any difference at all. If it hadn't been this crisis, it would have been the next crisis that was the trigger for the Generations Church. And so I think it's incidental. The details of the crisis that happened at EFCLA, at Harvest LA, that triggered the planting of Generations Church, I think it's incidental. It happened at that time because of that particular crisis, but it could have happened a year earlier, it could have happened 5 years later, because all the factors were in place that were pushing Generations Church out. So I think the specific crisis doesn't matter, but there was a crisis. And I could actually describe a crisis from my church in Chicago. You wouldn't know the difference. I could describe one from Taiwan. You wouldn't know the difference. They all are somewhat similar. So we did have a crisis here, and one of the people that emerged as the leader of the people who were going to start the church plant, and Elder Henry really is the only individual I'm going to mention today. Elder Henry, he's an insider in the denomination. He had been part of the founding of the denomination. His father is an elder, one of the founding elders of the church, so he's kind of a VIP family within the denomination. And when he was 10 or 12, he was the oldest EM ministry person, because they were all kids. And when he was 20, he was the oldest. When he was 30, he was the oldest. When he was 40, he was the oldest. At 50, he was still the oldest, but he was still part of English ministry. So there is a particular case study of someone who was never able to grow out of being in the English ministry. There were some hotheads in the English ministry, and they wanted to leave yesterday. When this crisis hit, they wanted out. They said, let us go now. And I think it was Elder Henry, maybe some others, but Elder Henry was really the one who stood and said, no, we can't go like this. So he's the one who was urging patience and encouraging the hotheads to let's do this right. Let's do this in a beautiful way. Let's do this in the best possible way. And so it started a period of prayer and careful planning and an attempt as much as possible at some reconciliation from the crisis that had occurred within the churches. So that was really a couple years out from our founding, but then we started to meet together a group of sometimes 20, sometimes 40, 50 people were meeting together for the Wednesday night prayer meetings. And it was a beautiful time where there seemed to be a single spirit emerging. I mean, some people standing up and saying, let's go now. But Elder Henry and others saying, let's wait, let's pray, let's ask the Spirit, let's ask God to guide us. And so this process took well over a year, and the planting of the new church, it was born in prayer. Vision was slowly developed. Something very interesting with the development of the vision is it turned out, something I didn't know, others within the church did know, but Elder Henry had actually had a dream about starting a independent church out of the English ministry several years earlier, before this crisis. And he'd had a clear sense that this was God's will. And he had images of what it would look like. He had a name for the church. And he thought that it was the time that the church was mature and ready to go. He brought that vision for second generation church to the elders here and to the pastors, and they weren't interested or they weren't ready, and nothing became of that. And he was very willing to say, okay, you know, if I have a vision, if there's a vision and there's no confirmation of the elders and the leaders of the church, then maybe it's not of God. I think we'll never know if they should have left at that time, or maybe it wasn't of God. Maybe it needed to wait another few years. But very interesting, because at this point, that vision more and more was being affirmed, that this seemed to be where God was leading us. So even the name Generations Church is the name he had received when he had the vision several years earlier. And so we begin, the core group began to emerge. 20 or so people were willing to take on the leadership of a church plant that would become independent of EFC, EFCLA, or Harvest LA, the English name of the EFCLA English ministry. One thing that we had in mind is there's some really cool Asian American ministries around, you know, young people, and they do cool things and they have good lights and good this and that. And we thought, is that what we want? And to me, that was never my vision. And I think a number of people really thought that the vision of the church and the name Generation suggests that it's not for the young, it's not for the cool, it's not for college students or young families. It's for them, but it's for everybody. It's for all generations. So it should be a church of one full-service church, one-stop shop, full service, so you can have your babies are born and confirmed in the church. They're raised through the Sunday school. They go through youth program, college group, into young adult ministry, married in the church, go through their life. Their children are born in the church. They grow old in the church, and they can be cared for in their old age. They can be cared for in when they're invalid. And then finally, the church can bury them. I think that was the vision that we had, a church that was for the whole family. generation to generation. So here's our mission statement. It's tweaked a little bit later. Our mission is for strong children's ministry, student youth groups, family home groups, older families mentoring young adults and young couples. Our service will first begin with English only. Focus on growing spiritually and nurturing second, third, and fourth generation kids. So Elder Henry, his kids are young adults now, third generation. And so we're seeing that the EFC churches are going to more and more be having third and fourth generation. As stated on our current webpage, we'd like to focus on nurturing families with second generation children. We want to prepare children and youth for the world, fulfilling the Great Commission. This is what we added. Our target geography is the Western San Gabriel Valley area, Southern California. We want to equip our members to share the good news, first to our community, then to the greater LA Basin and around the world. And so we started at 6 months meeting in Temple City, renting a old Lutheran church in Temple City.
Are they independent or totally under the EFC?
So we started intentionally under the EFC. And we are still intentionally under the EFC. And that will become a point as I go forward. A point of contention and a point of blessing.
Submission?
No. Yes. No, yes. Both. So there we are. It was after a season of prayer, 6 months, 12 months of these four people coming together, committing together. I am so thankful for Elder Henry and for those who were willing to wait, because by the time we left, we were able to have a service and a commissioning out of the EM ministry. And it happened not perfectly, but given the crisis, given the hurt feelings, I think it happened in the best way it could at that point. So I am very thankful for that. This is the people who came that first Sunday. We probably about half of these were our new membership. The other half or so were well-wishers, people who were coming to support us and to encourage us that first Sunday. So it's a fairly good-sized group. Maybe half or so were not planning to be part of the church. I agreed to preach that first Sunday. I actually agreed to preach at the English ministry here the second Sunday, because I just felt so torn. I was so committed to this new church, but so committed to the ongoing ministry of ESCLA and the English ministry here. Not having made up my mind, I agreed to preach once there and once here. As it turned out, God led me to end up being there regularly. However, that first Sunday, 2 days ahead of time, I got vertigo, which I had never really heard of, but it's a dizziness degree if you don't know what it is, and you can barely stand up, you can barely walk around, and so I had to sit during the service, and I read my notes like this, and I said, this isn't what I expected to be like on my first Sunday, but I think God was there. Was it spiritual battle? I don't know, but we had our first service, and my wife is holding me up so I don't fall over, and we had our first service February 7, 2016. I did agree, I came here that second Sunday to preach here, but I did agree to continue to preach regularly at the church. I felt like without a regular founding pastor to the church, with Elder Henry serving as the church planter, that it would be helpful to have stability in the pulpit. So I agreed to preach twice a month. And I have been so blessed to be part of that. In the second month, we added our first full-time pastor. He came in as a youth pastor. I think it showed our priority of really wanting to work with junior high, high school, and college age. But then within weeks, we had our first crisis. And God is so good, right? Because He just makes sure we stay close to Him in prayer. And again, the detail of our new crisis. Doesn't have to. It could have been anything, but it was this. Something I would say, there's spiritual battle going on. I think there are attacks from Satan. I do believe in that. But how to identify that or how to describe that, I don't know. But I do believe it's spiritual battle. I do believe we need to pray, especially for a young ministry like that. We had this crisis, and what I want to say about the crisis, I guess, is this. One of the core families, so it was a very close and intimate group by the time we prayed for a year, had this first service, and moved out together. It was a very intimate and close group. But one of the core, the members of one of the core families, they began to shift in their theological position away from what we believed was traditional Orthodox Christianity. To be fair to them, they felt that they were consistent and the church was not consistent. But the church, given their shifting, as we saw it, shifting away from what we believed, we worked as hard as we could to love them and to hold on to them and to correct them. But at the same time, they were feeling isolated and they were feeling pushed out. And it was tragic because it was like a slow motion accident, because for months we were trying to love and hold them in, and for months we felt they were pushing away. Like I say, they interpret it the way they perceived it, was we were pushing them out. And I guess I can empathize with why they would feel that way. So
the theological challenge is the crisis, or
the theological problem is the crisis, yeah. And so they did leave after a year, but after a long struggle. A long struggle. Something in hindsight that I have thought about that struggle is we just didn't expect it. I mean, we went and got outside counseling help. How do you handle an issue like this? What's the best way? One person, a Fuller professor, he suggested, I don't suggest you get involved in that as a new church. And we thought, well, we didn't think it was a good idea to get involved in this. We just, here it is, our brand new church, and we are involved. But looking back in hindsight, one thing I think, although it was so painful, because we loved that family, and we just felt that we couldn't help them see that we loved them still, that it was a theological issue. We couldn't get them to see that. Although it was very painful, I do suspect that it helped hold the rest of us together, because we really didn't have time to be upset at anybody else, because we were spending all our time on trying the best we knew how to love this one family. And so it did in some way maybe serve to draw us together. And one thing I want to say, so we are still part of the EFC. You asked that. And it was very important to be part of the EFC, because as they drifted theologically, we could not compromise. They could argue that that's not good theology, but we could respond that that may be, you know, that may be bad theology, but it is our conviction. It is in our statement of faith, and that's not negotiable. Because Generations Church, at 1 month old, we weren't going to be able to go to General Assembly of the EFC and change a fundamental doctrine of the church. That was it. And I thought about, if we had been an independent church at that moment, we could have done anything we want. And they would know that. But they also knew we couldn't change what was a fundamental doctrine of a denomination. And so that was a great help, I think, at that point, to help us get through that. And so I was very appreciative that we had the denomination at that point. So that's our first year. We're just surviving. We're trying to find our footing. The first service was over 100 people, I believe. I think we kind of settled after that to 50 or 60 people. And we were first meeting in a junior high school. After several months, we moved to the Lutheran church in Temple City. And we were up and we were going. and we were starting to grow. I think the hardest part of a church plant is the first year. So if we could go from 50 at the beginning of the year to 50 at the end of the year, we would already be a success. But I think we went from 50 or 60, maybe to 60 or 70, maybe a little bit more. There were some new families coming. The one family I mentioned did leave. So it was not a rocket start, but a solid start. And I'll say this other in the next, I'll say what I wanted to say in a moment. Here we are at our 1 year anniversary, February 12th, 2017, a year and a half ago, we had our 1 year anniversary. And again, we had some extra people coming to help celebrate with us. But we were probably 60, 70, or 80 about that point. And so February 12th, 2017, we had our 1 year anniversary. We felt like we were reaching some stability, and we decided to do a pastoral search. So the pastor, full-time pastor we had was a youth pastor, and I was doing the preaching and some informal advising for the church, but we felt it was time to start a pastoral search. Well, now we found we weren't so sure we wanted to be inside the EFC because there is a defined statement of faith, and we found some candidates who we might have liked, but they couldn't sign the EFC statement of faith. And we felt, oh, we got these handcuffs on us that maybe we don't appreciate, but there it is. So we started our pastoral search, which lasted for several months. The key issue, and this is an issue that I can just say publicly, because this is just an issue of all conservative evangelical churches, because you either are allowing for the ordination of women and you alienate one side, or you don't allow it and you alienate the other side. That's just the way it is. And so the EFC allows for the ordination of women, complementarian or egalitarian, the theological terms that are used. Egalitarian is that women can be ordained, that there it's equality. Complementary is that the roles are different. You're equal. Complementary, you complement one another. Men and women complement each other in different roles. So this would not allow ordination of women. Egalitarian often would allow ordination of women. And anybody who would come as the pastor of an EFC church has to sign the EFC Statement of Faith. And a lot of us at the church didn't have a clear conviction that you had to be either or of these two positions. And but some of the candidates we had were very clear on their conviction, and they could not, in good conscience, sign the statement of faith. And so that would be one of the downsides of being part of a denomination, is that if we had it to write ourselves, we might have written the statement of faith differently. So like I said, the first year, that was wonderful to have that behind us. The second year, we thought, that's kind of limiting us. So do we want to be part of the EFC? I think that came to the mind of some people. Why bother? I mean, it's a Taiwanese denomination, and it's in the United States. And here we are in San Gabriel Valley. Some of our new people are not Chinese at all. They're not Chinese background. Some of them are curious why the church has so many Chinese people in it. When we talk about the pain of leaving EFCLA or whatever, they have no idea what's going on, what we're talking about. They were no part of that church. And so the question comes, it still comes. I mean, this will continue to face. What is the value of being part of the EFC if you are an English ministry? Is there any value to it? Should we not just split? And why or why not? I think we'll need to continue, and we may forever have to continue to face that question. I think I already gave two points. One is it was helpful to have a pre-written statement of faith that gave us a framework. It hurt us maybe a little bit as we were doing our pastoral search. So that might be a negative point. At the end of the day, the reason I would hold on to the EFC is I love the EFC, the Evangelical Formosan Churches. Why do I love the EFC? Because they have a powerful DNA. If you know the history of the EFC churches, it was a church planting movement, and it was a movement of pastors, but also of lay people that love church planting, and they were effective in church planting, initially reaching out to the Taiwanese community in Los Angeles area, but then to other parts of the world going out into missions. It's a church planting DNA, and I love that. I also love that when you're part of the EFC churches, when you're at Logos Seminary like I am, when you're here, when you go out with Elder Henry to Generations Church, you see miracles. So it's not surprising that Elder Henry had a vision of a church called Generations Church, and that happened. I mean, when you think about it, it can give you tingles when you see miracles happening around you. That's something I've experienced with Reverend Felix Liu, the founding president at Logos Seminary. He's emeritus president at Logos now. When you're near him, you see miracles happening around him. When you're around EFC churches, traditionally, it's a place where God is present and things are happening. And that seems... These, to me, just these 2 points alone are worth holding on to tightly. I'm a church historian, and one of my favorite churches of all time is the Methodist Church. The Methodist Church was started by John Wesley, an Englishman, but it caught fire in North America at the time of American independence. Why would these North Americans want to be part of an English church? Well, it's not that far of a stretch. They wanted to be part. It's English-speaking in North America. But Methodism spread to Africa. It spread to Asia. It spread all over the world. And there's a wonderful book on Methodist missions. And that's where I take this term, the DNA. The DNA, people that wanted nothing to do with an English church, wanted nothing to do with English ministry, loved Methodism, loved Wesley because of the DNA, because of who Wesley is and the insight of the Wesleyan or the Methodist churches. And so Methodism has become a dynamic movement, culture after culture after culture, because of the DNA. It doesn't become an English church in North America. It doesn't become an English church when it goes to Africa or China or other parts of the world. It becomes part of those cultures, but it keeps this DNA of Methodism, the passion of John Wesley. And so I think there's something in the EFC churches that's worth preserving. So someone mentioned going to a seminar this morning on the future of Taiwanese language ministry in North America. I would say that may be a difficult problem, but if there is something powerful within the DNA of a Taiwanese church like EFC, that DNA can survive in different, in a Mandarin setting, in an English setting, and even into other language groups. And so I would argue at Generations Church that a reason for us to keep our EFC background is to preserve our DNA. They don't know, the new people in the church don't know our background. We need materials in English about our history, about our founders, about the key leaders, about Reverend Felix Liu and the founding of Logos Seminary. We need stuff in English so people can read and learn who we are, our history, and we can preserve that. I think we need probably more in Chinese, but we do have some in Chinese. We definitely need some in English as well. So here we are. We are in our second year. We're putting down roots. Our search for a pastor was a failure. We had a final after a very difficult search and going through more candidates than you would ever think you should. We finally voted down our last candidate. And so we move forward without a regular full-time pastor at the end of this year. And I guess I share that just as a fact, neither good or bad. Church was growing. Been first year, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think by here we're 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, up to 100 for a big event. And so the church is continuing to add new families. And then we come to our third year, and we, in that year, become an independent church. We move away from being a gospel station within the EFC churches, or a church plant, I guess is the best way to put it. We were a church plant of the EFC until May 6th, 2018. So our third year, we started February 2018. Earlier this year, we had our Declaration of Independence, May 6th, 2018. And that's our installation of deacons and elders. So we are an independent church within the EFC denomination. Before that, we were a church plant under the ministry of the EFC. And so that was a an exciting moment. And
so who's the pastor?
So we had no pastor, and we had Elder Henry as the church planter. We had the full-time youth minister. We had me doing preaching twice a month. And then the core committee was functioning as the leadership, and starting May 6th, the deacons and elders took over the leadership of the church. This was quite a process, because what we found out from the denomination is that you have to have a certain number of members. You have to have a quorum. You have to have enough members to percentage to vote for deacons and elders. And so to have members, you have to have members. To have members vote, you first have to have members. And so a year before this, we started a membership drive. We got people who were attending to become official members. They had to be members for 6 months or however many months, and then they could vote for deacons and elders from among the members. And so this was a longer process than maybe some of us had anticipated, but it was a great celebration that the church became independent under the EFC denomination. So
you are also a pastor EFC?
So I'm yeah.
Okay.
What? I'm a
resource person.
Yeah.
But that means you are the pastor at the EFC, the English.
No. I teach at Logos Seminary full-time.
Okay.
And then I'm have done mentoring and pastoral advising at the Generations Church. I've done the preaching, which has been more time-consuming, but also working with the pastors. And so, starting in 2017, I didn't mention him yet, but we had a young man become part-time pastor. He was a full-time teacher, third-grade teacher, but at the end of the school year, in June, he left his teaching job to become our full-time pastor. So he's associate pastor. So we have two associate pastors, still no lead pastor, and I'm the pastoral mentor or something like that. They put something on the webpage that calls me something, and I'm embarrassed by it.
They don't need pastor because of the experience that the lead pastor does. The pastor do not have the
I think if you ask people at church, if you ask 50 people, you'd get 50 different answers. So I don't think I know the answer to that. There are a number of reasons. There's gifting, there's calling, there's age involved, there's all kinds of factors involved. So since he started full-time, so just last month, 2 months ago, I went to once a month, and he's now twice a month. And then the youth pastor is once a month now. So I've dropped back to once a month.
How did EFC respond to your breakaway?
You're not higher than EFC, you are seminary.
I dare not answer that. I think EFC denomination likes us. I think EFC denomination has always wanted to have an English ministry. I don't think anything was happy about the, I don't think anybody was happy about the crisis that triggered the start of Generations Church, because nobody would like that. But like I said, every church has crisis, so there it is. But I think GA has always wanted to have English ministry. And I think how EFCLA responds, I'll let someone from EFCLA in another setting, I'll let them respond. Not right now. So I don't want to speak for them. But I think the GA has given us tremendous amount of support and really wanted to see this go. General Assembly. Yeah. And, okay, so we're in our third year. I would say we're averaging about 100, maybe a little over 100 now. And so we're continuing to grow, continuing to see things happen. And I would say we have a growing challenge emerging now, and that is, why exactly do we exist? What is exactly the point? Do we hope to continue to grow to 100, 200, 500? If we don't grow to 500, are we a failure? Are we happy to just be 100 and just be like this forever? Is that our goal? Is our goal to be like DNA, EFC, DNA, church planting? Is the vision to see more and more generations churches born around Southern California and around the world? What exactly is the vision and why? So I think that is becoming a question that's coming more into focus, particularly as you bring in new people. The second pastor, not part of the initial group that came over, and so when we talk about, oh, what happened at the old church, means nothing to him, or it doesn't mean anything to any of the new people. And so what is the point of this church? And so I think we're going to face that more and more critically this year and next year. We've succeeded, I would say, in planting a church, but now what are we going to do with that? What exactly is the vision? I think for me, my vision starting was to see a generations church movement, a church planting movement. And so that's how I would hope to shepherd the church, to have a vision to see more generations churches planted in the future. But again, it's now there's deacons and elders and other leadership in place, and so we need to come to consensus as a group as we move forward. It's no longer a church plant. It's an independent church that can do what it chooses to do. And so that's what we're really facing now. I think with this Declaration of Independence, well, now the question is, so what do we do? Now that here we are, now what do we do? Some final thoughts, and maybe we can get a little bit of a little more questions. Thank you for interacting already. Maybe we can think together about, can we do this birthing of Asian American churches, can we have these new churches born without a crisis? Do you wanna, maybe there's a minute or two for you to serve. Your church, you started an English ministry, and how you guys got going without a crisis?
Our church now actually last year called. We started a new Asian American church, we moved out the whole congregation, like English congregation, to become independent. But when using the townhouse model, first my English pastor, he learned from one of the professors, a Korean professor in Kelsey, and his friendship, he wrote a book, studying an analysis of different immigration churches, and given more to talk about, hotel model, trip, and townhouse model. Then he suggests a townhouse model. At least each congregation can work together with another church and let them independent still have a partnership. So we first listened to our his pastor talk about the stream, because he's serving in our church for 5 years already. His congregation ended up even more people because it's disciple. The cultural street, they don't come back. And then the youth will come up, and then another cycle, the class leaving, and then we come back, and then so this is like 5 years. Actually, when I interview, it depends on your senior pastor. I'm a senior pastor, I really like church planting. The first time I interview, you already asked me a question. if I want to plant a church to reach my problems, yes, of course, except I think the DNA here. So I'm the person who really like me to be empowered. So we bring up the model about board director. And then I told them, I shared your wife of the lesson independence. Because I think that the church don't have their own identity, they never can attract the Asian American in the same location. Mm-hmm. Same area. Because in Warner, we are living in Warner, there's so many Asian Americans, their background is not Chinese. They are, you know, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, you know, Singaporean, Indonesia. They all speak English. But they won't go to any Chinese church. Because when you have a Chinese church, the English congregation, the Chinese church, they do this as a Chinese church. Just like what you said, English congregation become a ministry only. It's not a church. So, and I'll have to try to analyze the, and you get this, you know, your back analysis. There are a lot of young couples that they belong to different ethnic in the background, but they speak English. So we have, want to reach out to them. So we talk for a year, and then we plan. And then the pastor, we have a vision for new church. We attend some of the church planning conference, mentored by benching, and then we work it out, and then we have a whole plan we decided to. And they're moving, we have a facility, so they're just renting a school. One of the conditions, the church, tunnels model cannot be far away from the mother church, because they are in different, but they still send people to help our children program, our youth program. So, we experience this kind of model, you know, people will say that you may lose your English congregation. To me, in fact, I'm not losing my English congregation. Because once they launch out, they bring 30 people, they grow into 18 people. So they have more power. And our youth group, and then you need one or two youth workers to help the youth pastor. Now there are 5 to 6 youth workers sent in by the youth church. They send the people to come to the youth. And then we told them, because when you nurture the youth, you might actually come to your church. So it's a growing process. Then we still have enough manpower. So I think once they intend that they have ownership, you see the whole congregation revival. Because when the only congregation, they're sitting there, most of young people, they just sit there, steam for. But once they see, this is my church, and then you can see the young people have an energy. I planted a church 19 years ago in Diamond Farm, and I see right now they're doing the same thing. Early in the morning, because we're at school, they have to move every equipment. Early in the morning, 8 o'clock, and then they have to leave the school in after 2 o'clock. All these young people, they start sign equipment, they move, they have graders, and they have different leaders. And then suddenly the whole English congregation raised up a lot of young leaders. So, this is a Thai model that is not really big to any all the churches. Mm-hmm. You have given condition. The church plant, the English pastor has to be a part of planning churches and give them. And he has to have good preaching and also pastor vision. Not every English pastor can be a townhouse model. It depends on leadership.
No.
The other thing, the mother church depends how open is the mother church to let go and empower and empowering. I think it's a trust base. Because I worked with my senior, English pastor for 5 years. I mentored him and nurtured. So we have a trust base, and we commit to partnership all along. So that's why we don't afraid that you break away from us.
No.
Mm-hmm.
So we still, they're still under association, under association part as well. So actually they still covered by the denomination. You know, so this is the way that, so we never argue.
Okay.
Unanimously, we just bless them, and then become, you know, so they just want next to you. I think this is a legal Asian American church. So okay. They're not splitting the church and forced to be independent, but we empower them. So this is what I think, if the Chinese church can give the English congregation more trust and leadership and work together, I think this is a good model. The kind of model is good.
I hear that, and I feel like that would be, to me, the dream model. I still would have to have a question mark as if the church can achieve the independence it needs when it's across the street. And there I just can't forget my father-in-law, who you know, no malice, no ill intent, but this is still the way ministry should be done, right? I think we just need to continue to observe how your experiment goes. I don't know. I think to me that would be the ideal way, but I just wonder. I still have a question mark.
Sure, because still in the future, you know, new people coming in, they might change their mind, right? So I think that's my perspective. If you foresee the kingdom perspective, in a way, it's not just a church. You own your own church. That is different. And also, my point is that I try to bless the young people. When I actually bless each other one year and so, I set up. But when I see all these young people, average 20 to 25 years old, all the foundation, most likely, you know, just there together. I see when they come, they decided to anniversary have a baptism on the same day. So to remember, when we launch it, that they baptize people on the same day in the school that we have launched as a business.
Yeah.
I see the testimony.
Another question. For this, I would say the two models. One is the townhouse model, one is the mother.
People have a model, therefore, just like they have mega church, the hotel model, just like mega church. And then they have churches, you know, you have, just like typical Chinese church, one church, we have, you know, many congregations, your Catholic congregation, English congregation, one roof under two roofs. You can meet your three congregations under one roof. I think that's what is very good about government.
So basically, for financial, the mother should support all these different congregations.
Our association has all of the church funding. So we have a mega church model. Talk about this. The mother church, the first year, will pick up 50% of the new church deficit, and association pick up 50%. For example, if the church, they have, you know, 10,000 years income, they deficit 2,000. Then the mother church will pick up 10,000, so the association will pick up 10,000. So that means that deficit will better. So this is the way they do it. They don't have worry about the financial.
Yeah, there's a lot of material on different ways to do church planning. One final thought I wanted to say before I miss my chance is what I didn't say yet is it's been so much joy to be part of that church. I think, like I said, when you're part of the EFC, the DNA is to see miracles happening. So you pray that we can be in the center of the San Gabriel Valley, and you look at a map and kind of see where the center is. And then we find a church that we're able to meet there, practically right in the center. But over and over again, things that we believe we should pray for, and we come together as a church and we pray and we see God blessing the church. That has been part of the experience. So there's been struggles that I've shared some, but there's been tremendous joy. And one of the things that can't come across here at all is with this group of people, there's fun, there's laughing, there have been baptisms, you know, people who've come to faith, and we celebrate their baptism in the church, and that's when it all comes together. There have been births with some of the young couples having babies, and it's just so much joy and fun to be part of this, doing life together. And so that's, I think, the genius of the name, Generations Church, that we're seeing this happening. I did just think I wanted to, just to make this a little more personal and to talk about my own. We still have 10 minutes? Yeah. I just wanted to go through my sermon series that I've done, just to give you an idea of what I was thinking as we were going through the church. So I went the first Sunday, and I did have in mind possibly a series, and I ended up picking that up and then agreeing to preach regularly. And so I just put up some of the slides and some of the things that I've been doing for 2.5 years. And I think that just shows my heart as being part of this and kind of the needs that I've seen arising as the church has gone forward. And so I've tried to do series of 4 or 5 parts. It's a chance to do exegesis of a particular passage, also a chance to move on so that you're not in the same book for 6 or 8 years, going verse by verse. So it's not topical, but not completely verse by verse is what I have tried to do. The first series I did was called Overwhelming Generations, obviously a play on our name, and Psalm 139. And if you remember Psalm 139, and this is where I started, that my goal in preaching, my goal, if the church is going to grow, people need to see the glory of God. If people are going to grow in Christ, they need to see the glory of God. If people are going to do evangelism, they need to see the glory of God. If people are going to do missions, they need to see the glory of God. When they see the glory of God, they'll become people of praise. When they become people of praise, they'll serve. And so that was the reason for this verse. And Psalm 139 is so powerful. It starts with, there's the 4 messages I gave. The knowledge of God, presence of God with us, creation of us, and God's obsession with us, and trying to just instill in us this passion for God. So that's what I thought of at the start, that we should be overwhelmed. We should be overwhelmed by the glory of God, by the love of God. And so that was the first series, and then that ended here looking at Joshua 24, which kind of was what we had to say in our first month or two at the church. Are we willing to stand up as the generation did with Joshua? Remember, Joshua was the second generation after Moses had led the Israelites out of Egypt, and Joshua then had to say, are we going to follow? Are we going to follow what Moses taught us? And so, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And so that was kind of a conviction, a commitment that I hoped that us and our families would make as we started our first series. Having done that, we went in the second series to look at the first 5 chapters of Joshua. Again, it works perfectly. He's a second generation. The first sermon I did on that, it was on Mother's Day, so I added that. But next man up, that when Moses dies, Joshua should step up. When our second generation comes of age, it's time for us to stand up. And so here my S has jumped off the page. That's Moses. Moses is a big figure in the way God has planned the Old Testament, the way God has planned history. King David is a huge figure. And as I was meditating on Joshua, Joshua isn't nearly as important as Moses. I guess Moses is so big he gets pushed off the page. He's so important. And so who is Joshua? Well, if there's no Joshua, can there still be the important King David? If there's no Joshua, can there still be, if we go down here, how big is Jesus going to be as part of this? And so as I was thinking about Joshua in this second generation, I said, boy, those guys are so important. Why? Because they're a cog in the whole machine, the whole mechanism of the plan of God. And so that's what I wanted for us to think about. That we might not be Moses, we might not be King David, surely we're not Jesus. But we can play our role in the plan of God. Whether we're a little tiny cog in here, we're all part of what God is doing. And so I did that out of the book of Joshua. As I was preaching through that, I had never preached on Joshua 2. I just loved this sermon because this talked about God's heart for the prostitute, God's heart for the non-Jewish people, and God's passion. And so as I was putting these slides together, I had to put this up because I just absolutely fell in love with that story of Rahab. And then we had of course we have holidays, major holidays. So I had the opportunity to preach our first series on Easter Sunday. The theme was Passions Turned Red, Love Ran Red, and Morning Glows Red. So this idea of the blood of Christ as we celebrated Easter for the first time as a church. Again, a beautiful milestone and a reminder and a focus on Jesus Christ. Going from there, I was thinking to think about the prologue of the book of John. The whole book of John is capsulized in the prologue, verses 1 through 18, of who is Jesus. That's what the book of John is about. The prologue is about the book, the Gospel of John, and so you get this short meditation on who is Jesus. And so we did that in July of August of the first year, and here you focus on the Word, the Witness, the World, Grace and Truth, four messages from the book of John. This should say hope. Again, the slide jumped. And that was October and November. And here's a letter that 1 Peter, it's supposed to be 1 Peter. It's a letter to the churches in his area. So I envisioned it as a letter. You know, we've been in business now for half a year. How about if Peter were to write us a letter? So a letter to the elect in the San Gabriel Valley was my idea. And what would Peter have to say to us? So a greeting to the elect in San Gabriel Valley, a hope, a lens of hope, a call to holiness. You are a people, a chosen people. So this encouragement that we can play a critical role of this second generation. Christmas, I gave my favorite story of all time, which is the story of Simeon. So I had a chance to preach this sermon that I've preached before, because I love Simeon. He waits for his whole life, and then Jesus is brought to him in the temple courts as a baby, and he holds the baby. So that was the Christmas sermon, two sermons for Christmas. And then after that, I wanted to think about what is it that we're offering to the world? The world is longing for things. Look at postmodern generation. They long to touch something, right? Interest in Eastern religions, all those things. They're longing to touch something beyond ourselves. Transcendence. They long for community. Postmodern. Their parents are divorced. They've gone through terrible struggles. They desire relationships. They desire community. The world longs for justice. Justice for people who've been oppressed, and they long for beauty. And so I did a four-part series that said, if you care about those things, then you should be Christian. Because you find the ultimate representation of all these points in Christ. And then Easter, our second Easter, then Mother's Day, this was one of my favorite sermons to do, because I brought my mother, who can't travel anymore. She's 85 and in Pennsylvania, but I brought her in via Skype. And so here I am with her in church. And I put this picture in because I think that's part of community. I mean, I think nobody knew my mother and nobody particularly cared to meet her, but, you know, people cared about me and it was Mother's Day, and I think that's what community is about. And so we had a beautiful several minutes at the introduction of the sermon as I thanked my mother, as I thanked all mothers that Sunday. That's my son holding the microphone for me, or her grandson. And then did a series on Revelation, churches without compromise. This isn't a typo, because I think, you know, you're already wondering, are you going to have compromise in your churches? And then we did a series on meditations on Christ from Philippians, again, trying to dig deeply into who is Christ and the Trinity. And now, since the new pastor has come on, we are doing the entire book of Acts as our plan. So the first series, Acts 1 and 2, again, Easter, and then Acts 3 to 5. We're currently on Acts 6 to 8. And next Sunday, a week from tomorrow, I will preach this. Paul, a new recruit to the witness program. That's the conversion of Paul. And I can't wait to preach. It's so exciting. And so that's part of what's fun about being in this church. It's having God's presence with the community. So, thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. So,
okay.
Yeah, in a minute, okay. So
yes.
Our next class will be 15 minutes later.
Okay, thank you all for
coming. Okay, here. You want to stop? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, 大家.